What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, this is The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. Today, Senator Elizabeth Warren has emerged as the loudest voice of liberal resistance in the age of Trump. But is she actually a danger to the Democratic Party? Plus, the secret document everyone in American finance wants to read. Our reporter has a copy. It's Thursday, February 9th.
Now, we can whimper, we can whine, or we can fight back. Me, I'm here to fight back. Yes! I'm here to fight back.
She was there at the Women's March in Boston the day after President Trump's inauguration.
We will not turn away children.
We will not turn away children.
We will not turn away families.
We will not turn away families.
She was there shouting into the crowd at Logan Airport, a red bullhorn in her hand, in the hours after the immigration ban.
It is illegal.
It is illegal.
It is unconstitutional.
It is unconstitutional.
It will be overturned.
It will be overturned.
At seemingly every moment of resistance since Donald Trump's election, Elizabeth Warren has shown up and become the face of Democratic outrage and a hero to the left.
Jennifer, why Elizabeth Warren when it theoretically could be Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden or Tim Kaine?
Why has she become the voice of the progressive left?
Why? Jennifer Steinhauer covers Congress for The Times.
So I think, first of all, when you think about Elizabeth Warren, you need to think about how she came on the scene in the Senate to begin with, which she was basically chosen by Chuck Schumer to challenge Scott Brown. Senator Scott Brown had come to represent the Tea Party movement, and Warren was the left's answer to that, if you will. And that's kind of been her brand. She's not known as the person who's famous for certain pieces of legislation. She's known as the person who rabble-rouses. She's known as the person who gives nominees a hard time in a hearing. And this is the position that she's taken. It's the identity she's chosen. So it makes perfect sense. And she won't be the only voice from the left, I would suspect, as we continue through the Trump administration. But right now, she is the most resonant one.
So all this momentum that we're seeing in rally after rally or event after event where she pops up, it feels like Republicans tried to put a stop to that on Tuesday night.
They are mothers, daughters, sisters, fathers, sons, and brothers.
It was a very specific and deliberate action to read the words of Coretta Scott King, the wife of slain civil rights leader Martin Luther King, on the Senate floor. It's hard to imagine a lot of other senators even
fathers,
trying to do that.
Sons and brothers.
Mr. President.
They are...
Mr. President.
The majority leader.
The senator is impugning the motives and conduct of our colleague from Alabama, as warned by the chair. Senator Warren, quote, said Senator Sessions has used the awesome power of his office to chill the free exercise of the vote by black citizens. I call the senator to order under the provisions of Rule 19.
Mr. President.
Senator from Massachusetts.
Mr. President, I am surprised that the words of Coretta Scott King are not suitable for debate in the United States Senate. I ask leave of the Senate to continue my remarks.
Is there objection?
Object.
I appeal the ruling.
Objection is heard. The senator will take her seat.
She likes these really grand gestures. Other people might have entered it into the record, which means, you know, please put this in the record, the congressional record.
But I won't read it.
I'm not going to dramatically read it from the floor. But for her, that did become, because of the unusual aspect of it procedurally And because of what she was fighting about.
Jeff Sessions, right?
Jeff Sessions, who is the nominee for attorney general, has been under fire, and which is a nominee who, frankly, a lot of Democrats are resisting because of what they think are his racial insensitivities mm-hmm. at a very intense time on that subject for our country. So I think it's timing, it's person, it's subject.
It makes me think that they see her as a real threat. Do they?
Well, I think there's two ways to look at this, right? And I'm not going to try to get inside the mind of Senator Mitch McConnell because that's just a place I don't belong. But I think there's two ways to think of it. One is, do they see that as a threat? Are they trying to put a stop to her? Are they trying to put an answer to her? That could be. But let's look at this in a different way. Do they see her as the perfect threat? Do they see her as too far to the left, where people being associated with her actually damages the party. In some ways, I think about this. I hate all these Super Bowl analogies. I truly hate them. But I do sort of think this is like the Patriots just wearing the Falcons down. You know, are they just trying to work Democrats into such a frenzy as they did when she was chastised in the floor of the Senate, which was very unusual, so that they get angry about everything and eventually kind of peter out? This is another theory, right?
Wait, so are you potentially arguing that they're actually trying to elevate her and therefore marginalize the rest of the party? I want to understand exactly what you mean.
I think that there is a reasonable theory to posit that, in fact, they see Elizabeth Warren for what she is, which is a symbol of the far progressive left. She's kind of anointed herself that, and the left is embraced that, and that she will ultimately lead her party too far to the left and damage them. And so why not help her along?
And it feels like the Democrats are looking for a certain kind of ferocity in whoever it is they're going to be turning to in this moment because of who Donald Trump is and how confrontational he is. I mean, is it because Democrats want it that she's doing it?
You know, I would just point out that she does this on her terms. She's not a spontaneous person. She's not spontaneous rage. She picks her issues. She picks her moments. She comes in. She grills a nominee. She gives her speech. Exceedingly well prepared. And then she doesn't walk down the hallway and then give 97 different interviews trying to explain her position. She generally rushes out of the building down to Rachel Maddow, who she feels is the appropriate platform for her to continue in this spirit with people who think like her, basically. She's kind of very much a symbol of our current media age. She speaks to people, through people, who share her viewpoints.
Does she have a desire to reach beyond that, the Maydow America, and become any kind of a unifying populist force?
That's a great question, and I think that's what everybody's watching right now. Look, a lot of these people that we kind of broadly call the 2020 possibles are a little bit like crabs in the glass right now for attention, right? You know, crawling all over each other. We saw Cory Booker do something else that was unprecedented, which was to criticize, to specifically go to a hearing, again, in this case, Jeff Sessions, and criticize a sitting fellow senator and oppose his nomination at his hearing. So a lot of people are looking to be the voice of the progressive left and the angry left and harness just anger. I mean, Democrats are just in a lather right now. They hate this president. They hate his behavior. They can't stand his nominees. There's nothing that they can do to stop them unless they can convince enough Republicans to go along with them, which basically they've not been able to mm-hmm. do. Now they're facing this epic Supreme Court battle after a bruising fight last year. So there's a lot of this anger, and she is the right voice for that. Whether she can have a broader appeal across the party and across the nation is very much, I agree with you, kind of remains to be seen.
Does she seem to relish her ability to get under Donald Trump's skin? I think of the phrase he uses to describe her, which is quite unflattering and very ethnically insensitive, Pocahontas.
Right. Stemming from her controversy over claiming some sort of Native American roots as part of her entry to college.
Right.
I think it's interesting. during the campaign, he had nasty names for all his Republican opponents,
right.
And he shriveled them with it. They really could never found their footing after they had been given their moniker, right? Little Marco never escaped that. And he sort of – and in fact, it stuck with him now when he couldn't at the end stand up to
Rex Tillerson,
the nominee for Secretary of State, when he said he was going to – he indicated that he might because of his stance on Russia. Little Marco came wandering back to haunt him. He's really created these things that have identified people, Lion Ted. She's managed to still say Elizabeth Warren. He has not been able to change her identity and define her. And she's, in fact, turned it around and somehow that thing that we all hear when you're kids, what you say about me says more about you than me. It kind of doesn't. But in his case, vis-a-vis Elizabeth Warren, I think it does. She's managed to make him look small. And I think anyone who can get under Donald Trump's skin in the party really does enjoy that. And that's probably a great deal of her power.
Jennifer, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray. And that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to the New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
How did you get this letter?
I don't think I can tell you that. This letter is considered so coveted slash private. Every page of every copy that I know about is watermarked.
Whoa.
With people's name, the recipient's name on it. My copy without the source. It's like a Hollywood script.
And yet it's an investment document. On Wall Street, there's a letter being whispered about, one that everyone wants a copy of, but very few people have actually seen. Andrew Sorkin is one of the people who has seen it. He's a business columnist at The Times, and this elusive letter he got, it's written by an equally elusive money manager, Seth Klarman.
Most people don't know him, but within the world of investing, he is a legend. He is a giant. He is the second coming of Warren Buffett to some degree. Among the investment class, he is it.
It's an explicit set of guidelines, a manifesto, answering a question that millions of Americans have been asking since November 9th. How should you invest your money in the Trump era? So this letter you obtained,
yeah.
What exactly does it say?
Since Donald Trump was elected, the market has gone on this remarkable run.
In the 48 hours since Donald Trump was elected to the Oval Office, the stock market has rallied, reaching new heights at each close. Take a look at the boards now. Right now,
on the expectation among investors and businesses that there's going to be tax reform, so taxes are going to be lower, which means higher profits, that there's going to be different trade policies, that there's going to be infrastructure spending.
I do expect the Dow to crack 20K for the first time in its 120-year history, and it is done.
Our grandchildren will remember.
The market has been on a tear. His letter effectively said, not so fast. I'm not sure this is actually how it's going to go. In fact, I'm worried it's going to go the opposite direction.
So there's two elements it feels like worth breaking down. The first is, what does he fear that an America First economic vision will do?
Well, I think what he's looking at right now is he's saying to himself, you know, you can create jobs in America by forcing companies and jawboning companies to create a new factory here, but that isn't long-term work, meaning in the age of technology and AI and robotics, you can't hold back the march of progress. Technology is going to take these jobs anyway.
So it just feels good, but it actually isn't really going to
It's a sugar high. It's a sugar high.
So the second thing Klarman brings up, and I want you to explain this because it's complicated, is inflation and why he thinks that the Trump economic agenda will be inflationary.
What he thinks is about to happen is you're going to temporarily inflate the economy through these short-term measures. That is going to force the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates.
And which makes borrowing more expensive.
Which makes borrowing more expensive. But doesn't just make your credit card more expensive. It makes all of the things the government has paid for effectively on its credit card that much more expensive. So all of a sudden, the bill is going to be so much higher.
For everyone.
For everybody.
But he put some language in his letter that I thought was interesting for an investment manager. And let me read you a quote. This one is about Donald Trump's leadership style. Klarman wrote that the erratic tendencies and overconfidence in his own wisdom and judgment that Donald Trump has demonstrated to date are inconsistent with strong leadership and sound decision-making. That sounds like a form of investment advice in its own way.
Absolutely. Seth Klarman and every investor to some degree are in the business of betting on executives and leadership style. When you buy a stock or invest in a company, you're deciding that the people who are leading it are doing the right things and are going to make the right choices. And that's what he's doing in the political context. There's one big caveat to mention about this letter, which is to say that despite what Seth Klarman has described, we don't know right this minute how he's actually investing. There are investors that say certain things publicly, often about politics, but sometimes their investments aren't necessarily aligned. Warren Buffett very famously...
In just a minute, I'm going to talk about my favorite subject, which is going to be...
For the past year, he campaigned in support of Hillary Clinton.
What Hillary can and will do in the 8 years following January 20th.
I think he was actually helping take people to the voting booth.
To get her elected.
There have been a couple of things said by Donald Trump in the last few weeks that I... wait till you hear them, then you'll really boo.
And yet, after Donald Trump won, he has put something on the order of $12 billion with a B to work, meaning he's invested more money in the stock market, betting it would go up.
To capitalize on the Trump economic boomlet.
Right. And by the way, thus far, he's been right.
I think the reason we care about Klarman, besides his kind of past record, is that everyone's trying to get to the bottom of an essential question, which is the Trump economic boom a bubble? Is it real?
I think the consensus view among the investment elite at the moment is that they want all of these things to happen. They want tax reform to happen and taxes to go lower. They want infrastructure spending. They want all of these things to happen, but they're praying it's real, but they know that it may not be.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Here's what else you need to know today. Donald Trump has his eighth cabinet member, and it's another polarizing one. Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions is now the attorney general, despite Elizabeth Warren's protests. President Trump lashed out at the panel of federal judges deciding the legality of his immigration ban.
It would be so great for our justice system if they would be able to read a statement and do what's right.
He called the judges disgraceful, which seemed to unsettle his Supreme Court nominee, Judge Neil Gorsuch, who described Trump's attacks as demoralizing and disheartening. That could be an attempt by Gorsuch to distance himself from the president, or he could be trying to reassure Democratic senators who have the power to block his confirmation. The president has also found a new target for his derision, a department store. He scolded Nordstrom for dropping his daughter Ivanka's clothing line. "She's a good person," he tweeted, "always pushing me to do the right thing." While Nordstrom may have accidentally waded into presidential politics, the rest of the fashion industry is trying to be much more restrained at their annual runway shows, which begin this week in New York.
You know, fashion has always been very careful about separating their personal politics from their product politics. In 2016, designers became publicly political, and in fact political on the runways in a way that I think was pretty much unprecedented.
Vanessa Friedman is the fashion critic for The Times.
So I think we're going to see if the statements occur on the runway, you know, how overt they are, if we get slogans, if we get specific kind of casting of models that, you know, underscore diversity and immigration potentially, if we get clothing that clearly references, you know, other cultures in a way that might be more pointed than in the past.
I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.